or picking up empty cups, but it's just movement for movement's sake. I'm thinking about Grams in the cemetery, how she sits on her porch with a fan blowing straight into her face and watches the graves, some dry and hard, some still soft and round, as though a large animal has recently burrowed in and built a nest there. I wonder if they bother to announce the death of a foreigner. Maybe they do so with a little spark of glee. Even white people with disposable income can die here. In this place they flock to snap photos of the blue-black sea, the bay where sunken columns mark the spot where Cleopatra once bathed. They come here to marvel, but sometimes they find out what the people who live here already know. No amount of beauty will keep you alive forever. I pull my beard down because I'm feeling hot and faint, and I don't at this moment care if I get fired. The fat Russian man did not even exist to me this morning. He was one of hundreds of resort guests whom I may or may not have laid eyes on. But now, by afternoon, he is singular, and he will be in my life forever. I will bring him to bed with me tonight, his face-down form floating in the pool of my mind. He will come to my last year of high school, maybe appear in my college essay, will be one of the stories I tell a beautiful girl I have a crush on to make her love me. I'll bring him home with me, give him to my mother to share with me, though it would be kind to spare her, to tell her only the easy stories of sun and sea, of kebabs and soft breads. I will poison her with this death and upset her peace, because sometimes a person deserves company. I find myself looking at each person who passes and thinking, that guy is going to die, and that woman is going to die, and that little girl in the buttery pigtails is going to die. I understand Grams's interest in the cemetery, in the underworld. She is there to check the names off a list of everyone in town, as diligent as a scientist proving a hypothesis. Even the pretty young thing with the baby, even the woman so old it seemed she might just forget to pass on, even the imam, even the politician's daughter. She does not tire of the proof. She survives by it, waiting to hear her own name on the loudspeaker, to hover as a ghost on her porch, to see her own box lowered into the good earth, to measure, finally, the love she has accrued. I almost look forward to going home tonight and telling her about what I have seen. I imagine being on the receiving end of her offerings, the tulip glass of tea, sugar cubes, sweets. I think about the dead man and his wife and wonder who is waiting for them in Russia. There must be children, grandchildren even, brothers and sisters, a whole root system beneath that fallen tree. There must be a lot of paperwork involved in transporting a body back home to be buried. Until it is completed, the wife will have to stay in the fake cheer of Club Zeus, trapped on our merry-go-round. Kids perpetually flinging themselves down the water slide, men revving the jet skis so that the vibration jiggles their aging testicles, women sliding the strings of their bikinis to check on the progress of their bronzing, everyone pouring drinks down their gullets, too much to eat at every meal. This is the last place where a person should have to mourn. The pool has to be drained. There is no yellow police tape in Turkey, I guess, but people do not need to be told to stay away. The guests make wide circles to avoid the empty blue hole, which is at the center of the complex and impossible to avoid. They have taken on an animal skittishness. Their eyes dart, and they take short, nervous steps. The hookah bar near the pool gets no customers. The alcohol bar, equally close, is full. Fact I now know. When one of your fellow holidaymakers dies in your midst, you do not stop drinking the bottomless drinks. Your wristband is paid up for the whole week. It's only Tuesday, and there is no possibility for a refund. You ask for an extra maraschino cherry. Raise your plastic glass to the dead man. You admire the female Ukrainian butts all around, perfectly sized and golden brown, the peak of white skin where the thongs shift as the women high-heel saunter. you burn and peel. The higher-ups have asked that everyone stay late in case the police want to question us. I try to call Grams to tell her that I won't be back for dinner, but she does not answer the phone. When the sky finally darkens, I go out to the swan-supported island, hoping I will be alone. In the corner is a statue of Leto, half-clothed, holding her newly born twins on a drifting island. They look happy. They are a family, and maybe that is enough. They know who they love. I lie on the tile floor listening to the water lob itself into the pilings. Finally, I dial the number. Mom, I say, as if I am prompting her to be that person. Oh, hi, sweetheart. When I tell her about the fat man, there is a thick silence. I hope the story hurts her. I want her to share what I am feeling because my pain is part of her job. Love, she says. Oh, love. But she sounds proud of me, as though she is congratulating me for achieving a long-held goal. I try again to capture her, to drag her into my sadness. I say, he was just floating there. His dead body was just floating there. There was a pause, and I think I may have succeeded. Then she tells me, my friend Ashtar was over today, and he saw that picture of you when you were 5 with the tractor. He said you have an old soul. You are stronger than you know. What she means is that I am on my own. What she means is that tragedy is also currency, that enlightenment depends on grief, that love grows in soil that has been tilled. For a moment, I wonder if she planned this whole thing, if she prayed to all her gods not for my safety or for my happiness, but for me to be deepened, opened, undone so that I might begin to blossom into my truest self. The water continues to roll into the pilings. The god of the sea must be hungry and sorry. The pilings are stoic and disinterested. After a long time, I fall asleep. And sure enough, the fat man joins me there, lying next to me face down, as if he is waiting for someone to rub sunscreen onto his big freckled back. A handful of fingers are in my hair, waking me. They're thin and curious, and I jerk away. A woman is kneeling beside me. There's enough light to see that it is the dead man's wife. Her face is hollow, as if she is wearing a mask. Beneath, what could she look like? What dark cavern would I find? I must love somebody, she says. I'm sure you do, I answer, thinking her statement is an existential one. No, now. And she falls into me, her lips on mine, suctioned. I try to pull away, to turn, but she has a hold on me that I can't break. I am the dock, and she is the snail. The dead man's wife's tongue is in my mouth now, slipping and searching. And then she is rolled on top of me, and the air goes out of my chest. I am just a place, a heat source, and that is enough for her. Keeping my arms pinned to the floor, she kisses up and down my neck. Her tongue in my ear is incredibly loud, like a sudden storm. I can still feel the fat man nearby, floating, and I think maybe the woman can feel him too. Maybe I am him right now to her. I notice that I have sustained a small wound for the dead man's wife, like a paper cut somewhere inside me, sharp-edged and very distinct. It reminds me of when my mother would forget to pick me up at school on time, how I'd stand in the semicircle driveway watching the sun sink and worrying that she was dead or trapped someplace until her car finally glinted into view and my sadness shifted through relief and into trying to soothe her guilt. Don't feel bad, I'd say. It's okay. It's not cold out. And then I kiss the dead man's wife back. Out of resignation? Out of kindness? Because I felt a flutter somewhere deep? Sensing me agree, she lets my arms go and I wrap her up, feather my fingers over the folds of her neck. Her skin and my skin are as different as paper and rubber. I imagine what I know about the Soviet Union and Siberian prisons and Chernobyl crashing up against the dullness of my life like a battering ram. Bread lines, the KGB and nuclear disaster, the endless sunny emptiness of being a teenager in Orange County. They bust open the frozen banana stand summers, the pack of blonde children learning to sail, the Ferris wheel hand-holding, the failed marriages, the less-than-perfect mothers, the kids who return after the first year of college, and everything they wear head-to-toe is branded UCSB, Harvard, Texas A&M. Gloriously, my life is torn to shreds by the dead man's wife. None of this is real, says the fucked up history of her country, her brand new widowhood. Nothing, it says, has truly ever happened to you. I kiss the dead man's wife and let my hands go up her shirt, cup the soft egg sac of her breast. It is the wrongness that feels the best. The fact that I cannot justify this night. I am doing someone a disgusting favor, inadvisable in every way. She is doing me a favor, too. A simple physical pleasure rolls through me. She does not take my clothes off, maybe because she knows my skinny, half-grown body would be ruinous to her fantasy. I keep pushing my shirt up, and she gently smooths it back down. I have sunk far enough into this warm wrongness to want it to go all the way, for us both to come up gasping at the end, to not even be able to look each other in the eye. I want to walk around for the rest of the week knowing what I've done. As I am getting ready to dip my hand below the waistband of her denim miniskirt, I hear something shuffle. The dead man's wife sits up. Here's what I hear. She pulls her tank top down, but not before I see the tan folds of her stomach in the moonlight. She has the same stretch marks as my mother, a white road map on her sides. I remember pulling at my mother's skin, asking her why she was tracked like that. "You did that to me," she told me. "You grew and grew and grew, and I had to stretch and stretch and stretch." Someone appears on the steps nearby. It's my boss. I try to gather myself. The blood leaves my crotch. "The woman has been calling and calling," Amir says. "My mother?" "No, no. Here, where you are staying." I think of Grams on her porch, waiting for someone living or someone dead to appear. She was worried. It never occurred to me that she would miss me. I wish I were on the porch with her, looking out over the graves, the night sea just a shadow in the distance. Neither the widow nor I explain why we are here on this floating island in the sea, why we are alone. Maybe I'll be fired. It's almost the end anyway. I am leaving in 2 weeks, and Turkey is very far from my home, and Grams is old, and we are unlikely to ever see each other again. Amir's hair, thick with gel, shines in the moonlight. He gives me a little head shake as if he knows every terrible thing I will ever do. He must be used to bad holiday behavior, but this is of another order. The widow turns to me and puts her palm on my forehead as if I am sick. She looks at Amir, and her eyes are soft. "Good boy," she says, coming to my defense. "I wish that I were younger, that I could feel the feeling of being a child with a person who knows how to take care of me." Out of habit, I close my eyes. Her skin is cool, and cooler still is the metal of her wedding band. I imagine its counterpart on the finger of the drowned man, his skin swollen around that bright promise. My mother was right. Pain is an enzyme, and I am softened. A year from now, when a girl asks me if I've ever been in love, I will lie and tell her no, but only because I will not know how to explain this night. Love, I want to say to the widow, to Amir. Love is an island. But when I open my mouth, the words get tangled. It begins to rain again. Amir clears his throat, trying to prompt us all to return to our separate lives. But when I lean into the widow's hand, she holds my head up. Below us, all the world's water.
High Desert. 2,000 years after her people left Jerusalem, and 80 years after they left Turkey, and 50 years after they left Poland, and 29 years after the death of her daughter, the woman walks down the desert road, and she feels her body letting go of her. She is not dying. She's not sick, even. Her body is detaching itself. In fact, it is just that her uterus is heavy and falling. But she feels like her body is untying the knots and setting off. The sky is rich blue. Clouds puffed. The dirt road dusts her shoes. She looks up at the mountains, the open sky. The doctor's secretary says to come on in. Each step, the woman feels the falling thing. "Get back in there," she whispers. "There is no place else to go, I'm sorry to tell you." "You aren't dying," the doctor says. "Yes, I am," she tells him. "So are you." "Ha," he says, "ha." "Anyway," the woman prompts him. "It's not a big deal. Your uterus is falling is all. It's gravity, our old friend." "What do we do about it?" "You won't need it, I'm guessing." "How many women live in your house?" she asks him. "Plenty, I guess. How many do we need? One is enough." The woman had a husband, and she had a daughter, and they lived on an island in the Caribbean. And it's possible to remember that time as good, easily and simply good. There was lobster and sun, and the husband worked in a shop, and the daughter went to school, and every Friday they lit candles and put their hands on the same kind of bread, while the rest of the country waited to pray until Sunday. It was good, because it could have gone a different way. Because the parents of the woman and her husband had died, and the uncles of the woman and her husband had died, and the towns where they had been born were entirely emptied of Jews. But these two did not die, and they crossed the ocean when they were still children, and they were welcomed to this island, and they grew up and met and fell in love and married and worked and had a baby, and all they had to do was never look too far east. But then this daughter, this girl, she went to the beach one day when she was 15, and she did not come back. Her friends said it was a wave. The sea swallowed her up into its blue, blue, blue. The sea was hungry, or the gods of the sea were, and they never spit the girl back out. There were searches by air and by boat and on land, but the woman knew from the moment she heard the news that the girl would not be found. And when she wasn't, the husband swam out too and let the sea claim him, and the woman took a bag of things and set out to find a desert. The doctor's office features photographs he took himself of Machu Picchu, Ayers Rock, the Great Wall of China. He is wearing a huge turquoise bracelet, and his arms are tan. He sees her looking at the photos and says, "There is nowhere like New Mexico, though. We are so lucky to live here." The woman lives here because it is dry and far above sea level, but she admits that it is beautiful. "We have two choices," the doctor tells the woman while she lies down, feet in stirrups, legs up, waiting. "We fashion a kind of plug, made to fit you, which pins the uterus back up inside. You come in once a month and I clean the plug and replace it." That sounds dreamy. I guess we get a lot of chances to get me in this position. "Oh, there's no need to feel embarrassed. I do this all day." Option two, we take the thing out. The whole apparatus. Apparatus, the woman thinks, as if it were rusted screws and oxidized iron. The woman does not want to go home after her appointment, so she takes the bus to the mall. She has no intention of buying anything, unless there are any deals on practical handbags. She needs no more of these, has not needed more for decades. She has many small, sturdy purses with useful pockets nested in her closet. She does not buy them so much as adopts them. On sale instead are bright lacy panties. Not cotton, like she wears. She holds lime green thong underwear in her hand. They are 75% off. Today only. They look fertile to her, and she finds herself wanting them, needing them, for the possibility of love more than the love itself. She takes four pairs to the counter. "Okay," the sales lady says, "panties." Thinking of sex and fertility and bodies, the woman says, "People are probably having babies today." "I bet you're right." "And dying." "Okay," the sales lady says, stuck now in a conversation she was not trained for. "Well, here are your panties. I hope you have fun with your panties. I hope you have a blessed day." The woman stands on the corner outside the mall and unbuttons her coat. Who knows what time of year it is on a day like this? The problem is not her affliction, which is painless and possible to remedy. The problem is that her body was once a house where her daughter lived. The problem is that the two of them lived there together. The room her daughter occupied, the room where she swam. It's impossible for the woman to forget this fact, that her girl was a swimmer first. Has been a silent comfort. All these years she has carried the tiny inland sea her daughter swam in. Thinking of it this way makes it more possible to survive against the real sea with the girl in it. Three teenage girls approach in short skirts, and though it is a nice day for this time of year, it isn't that nice a day. There is nowhere to go in this town, nothing to do, and the woman feels sorry for these girls who just want to take their young selves out and be seen. The woman studies their faces, just like she has studied every face of every girl, in case it is her girl. In case her daughter has found her way home. Her daughter would have been 44 now, but it is the faces of 15-year-olds that the woman always looks at. "Here, have a pair of panties," the woman says to one of the teenagers as the group passes. The girl does not take the panties. "Please," the woman says, "take them from me. Nothing is wrong with them. Everything is going to be fine." "Fucking weirdo," says the teenager, and goes on. People want to buy things, but they do not want things for free. People do not know how to accept a gift. The woman gets on the bus and looks out the window. A purple bruise of a storm darkens 20 miles away, and the woman watches it move across the juniper and pinyon. She knows she will be able to smell the rain long before it arrives. The old woman looks over a pamphlet given to her by the nurse. On the cover is a pencil-drawn picture, like an art class sketch, of a naked woman with all her anatomy visible. The person, as these people always are, is standing with her arms a few inches away from her hips, her palms out. She looks like she is waiting to be saved, to be taken up to heaven or to dive from a great distance into a deep sea. Above her are the words, "Your happy hysterectomy." Inside are facts. 1 in 3 women in the United States has a hysterectomy by age 60. It's the second most common surgery for women after the C-section. The hysterectomy can either be completed by making an incision through the abdomen or by going in vaginally. If it's possible to go in vaginally, the recovery time can be less than 2 weeks. Having the uterus removed before menopause has greater side effects. Ask your doctor about hysterectomy. The woman puts the brochure down on her lap. The rainstorm is still far away. "What are you so worried about?" she asks her impatient body. "We're Jewish, did you even know that? We don't have a heaven. We have Israel, but it's easy to die there and it's hot. They would like to think that you can get a good bagel, but it isn't true. You helped me make a daughter. I'll always be grateful for that. If there's anything left of her, would you please leave it with me? I hope it works out for you, wherever you're headed." The day itself is easy. The woman's neighbor comes with her, waits in the lobby, picks her up at the end, and takes her home. The woman goes to sleep. When she wakes up, she is foggy, with worn-down anesthetic and pain medicine. She looks up, and there in the chair beside her bed is her daughter. She is dripping wet, her hair matted and green, her feet slightly webbed. The woman cannot stand up, so the girl comes over to her and lies down beside her mother, soaking both of them. She smells sweet and reedy, and the woman begins to weep and kisses her girl on the forehead. Her skin is warm, still warm, despite all those years in the water. The woman wants to lick her daughter dry. "When you were a little girl, 6 years old, I came in and found you sitting on the floor looking at your palms. I remember you were wearing a t-shirt with two cats on it that said, 'Sophisticated.' I asked you what you were doing, and you said you were checking to see if you were a saint." "A saint?" I asked you. "I'll get cuts in my hands if I'm a saint," you told me. "This is embarrassing," the daughter says. "But you weren't a saint. You were a fish. How could we have known?" They lie in the bed for hours, possibly days. They drift off. Awaken. No one gets hungry. No one gets thirsty. No one moves. The room turns gold with evening light. Who knows which evening it is? And the woman sits up for the first time, and they look around. The brochure from the surgery is on the nightstand. At the daughter's suggestion, they cut the figure out of the picture. The daughter goes to the kitchen, her feet awkward on the floor, slapping and leaving a trail of water, and comes back with a newspaper. She folds it into a 3-inch-long boat. She turns the hot water on, leaves it running. She helps her mother into the bathroom, and they both sit on the floor. The daughter places the ship in the water. "Time to go to sea." The bath fills higher. The thing floats along, bobbing. Right away, the newspaper soaks through. "Did you ever encounter your father? He went in after you. There are a lot of ways to take care of someone. the girl says. He did his best. Don't tell me if you suffered. Don't tell me what it was like in the water before you got used to it. The bath is full to the brim, but no one reaches to turn it off. The boat gets lower and the newspaper begins to bloom. The little lady figure is still slick and stiff. She floats on her back, her arms out. The woman puts her head on her daughter's shoulder. Water begins to spill over the lip of the tub. It is warm and good. The floor is wet. The bath mat is wet, and the water keeps pouring. The little figure washes over the side of the tub and floats now on the pool gathering on the floor. The mother lies back in the warm, wet room, and the daughter lies back in the warm, wet room, and they put their arms out. They grab hands and float.
Heaven. It's his address, the man tells himself, that makes love so difficult. His house is at the junction of the river of stealing and the falls of eternal despair. The man often imagines how he'd give directions, if anyone would ever come looking. It's left at the pond of bowling. If you get to the pond of cards and saloons and church lotteries, you've gone too far. The man feels clear that he is only here because land was cheap, cheaper even than on the lake of private dancing. He's no sinner, he says. The plan is to fix the place up, sell for more than he paid, get into a condo or a loft, stacking washer and dryer, stainless fridge. He sits on the porch, looking up at the bright white mountain of heaven, not at all far away, hovering. He is handsome and sturdy, the kind who profits from his good investments. These swamps are feverishly green, saturated earth that can't help but invent 100 new kinds of vines each year. His is a floating house, tethered to the deepest roots of the vines with fresh ropes. The ropes the man makes from the sinner's old clothes, the relics of their lives, cast out in a last attempt to be forgiven. What if I throw away everything, they say, nakeder and nakeder as they go. The man in the floating house doubts that a late decision to abandon one's shirt is enough to get saved. The man shreds the guilty rags quickly because the specificity of them makes him sad. This faded pink and gray flannel shirt with a ring in the pocket from 30 years of carrying the same brand of chewing tobacco. Stains on the front from splattered spit brine. Loneliness. On a strange, bright day, sun where there isn't usually any, a dress catches on a branch. It is red, meant to tie around the waist and be untied by a true lover, and holding it makes the man feel suddenly very far away. He imagines pulling the dress's woman onto the good earth, a vision, her whole self bared and holy and ready, everything unbeautiful washed away. How long it has been since he's touched someone. The man hangs the dress as carefully as if it is the woman's shell. The arms are empty and begging, and the man comes close and wraps them around his body. They are grime wet, and they stick to his skin. He is held on to.
The Dream Isles. The animal mummies wish to thank the following. For generous donations in support of their preservation, the animal mummies wish to thank the Institute for Unforbidden Geology, the Society for Extreme Egyptology, the Secret Chambers of the Sanctuary of Tot Club, and President Hosni Mubarak, who may seem to have been around a long time, though not from a mummy's point of view. they wish to thank the visitors who make it to this often skipped corner of Cairo's Egyptian Museum, which bears none of the treasure of King Tut's tomb, and to the British colonial government, without whom the animal mummies might still be at rest, deep in granite tombs, cool and silent. They would like to thank Hassan Masri of Cairo, Alistair Tremblay of London, and Doris and Herbert Friedberg of Scarsdale, New York, for their support of climate-controlled cases to house the animal mummies for the rest of time. The animal mummies will admit they are somewhat surprised that this is what the afterlife has turned out to be. Oak and glass cases, Windexed daily. A small room, tile floor, chipping paint, the smell of dust and old wood. Even for the permanently preserved, the future is full of surprises. The animal mummies wish to thank their mothers, and their fathers, but mostly their mothers. Gauzy now, 2,000 years later, they still remember being licked and suckled. The vole mummies remember the feel of their mother's teeth grazing, painlessly, absent-mindedly, across small, tufted cheeks. To be a vole like this, forever, unendingly as the vole mummies are, is to know humility. No one asks to be born a vole. No one dreams of millennia of voldom. The vole mummies would like to thank everyone who, through these drawn-out centuries, has not confused them with moles, muskrats, mice, or shrews. They would like it noted that they are proud to have been small enough to hide beneath the bed, listening with their soft, round ears to the pharaoh and the queen, rattling toward a different kind of eternity. In their memories, they are a mighty brigade, moving soundlessly through the kingdom, pouring tubers on the banks of the Nile. The snakes assume that someone would like to thank them for being so easy to enshroud. The museum-goers wear shorts and hats and T-shirts with names of places on them. Kenya, Norway, Hawaii, as if they are trying to communicate their origin to the dumb natives. We do not care what dirty modern city you sleep in, what sad vacation you once took, the cat mummies think. Where did the cats come from? Where did they live? At the feet of queens, on the banks of the mighty river. The cats were a million gods. In those days, when a cat died, its family shaved their eyebrows in mourning. If a man killed a cat, whether he meant to or not, he was sentenced to death. Those were days of justice. Last week, when the squat man in a blue suit clomped up the stairs to their dusty little museum tomb and hung a plaque on the wall stating, "The animal mummies wish to thank the following," with a list of donors, the cat mummies thought, "Do we? Do we really? Doris and Herbert Friedberg?" Next, they figured, they would be told to bow down to a group of 10-year-olds and their imbecilic drawings of pyramids. "You'll have to find a vole to do that," the cat mummies snickered. If the cat mummies must be grateful for one thing, it is that they are forever cats and not forever rodents. The cat mummies can think of nothing so embarrassing as that. The great gift a vole gets is, finally, to die. If he is very lucky, his toothy little life comes to an end at the paw of a stealthy feline. The Nile crocodile mummy would like to thank the egg from which she hatched, though she does not remember such a time. She would like to thank the Nile, for obvious reasons. She would like to thank the ship full of sailors that ran aground for those lovely thighs and buttery soft drumsticks, and also for their bracelets and jeweled rings, which she has kept in her great preserved belly since. Life now, and death, are given meaning by the cold weight of those treasures in the center of her lengthy body. The crocodile mummy would not like to thank whoever it was that stitched her jaw shut to keep her from biting in the afterlife. If only she was not staring for all time at the small nugget of a vole, unable to open her giant jaws and clamp the bite-sized creature between her knife-edged teeth. She dreams of meeting the man who mummified her, and ever so carefully running a silk thread through his upper and lower lips. The baboon mummies would like to thank their owners for having the foresight to remove the baboon's canine teeth, so that they, forgetting their master's fragility for a moment, could not bite off a little finger and chew on it before the fury of guilt and regret kicked up like a storm. The eggs wish to thank the idea of life, which has reassured them over the centuries that they were preserved in earnest, not simply because the priests mummified anything they could get their hands on. The eggs have been waiting for 3,000 years to find out what they will hatch into. Will they become crocodiles or hens? Surely, when the egg mummies finally crack, it will be a god who has broken them. Gratitude is not what the dog mummies wish to give. Their museum tag explains, "In Abydos, Upper Egypt, dogs were buried in the same area as women, archers, and dwarves." The dog mummies are insulted. Is there some through line, a theme they do not understand? Once the thin-nosed guardians of young kings, they now find themselves in a permanent state of death, crusty and gawked at. "What an honor," the dogs snicker. Life, that single luminous moment, would have been enough for the dog mummies. They remember their names, North Wind, the Fifth, and Useless. They remember stalking the night-dark graveyard where the stones were still warm from the day. Caught rats and voles flicked their tails against the dogs' noses. Children moved aside in the market when the dogs passed. When they died, old and tired, full of the memories of the long walk their lives had been, they were ready for that to be the end. So who, then, would the dog mummies like to thank? Each other. Because they were a living pack, and now they are a pack frozen in time, each with one front leg bent, waiting for the right moment in this eternity to make a run for it. There are also bodiless mummies, shaped mostly like cats. Empty spaces, preserved forever. They wish to thank their mothers, though they have none. Instead, the nothing mummies would like to thank the priests who made them, carefully as they did, as if what was inside was sacred, as if to wish for a cat is to create one. Before these priests, they were just cat-shaped gusts of air, invisible. Now they can almost remember what it might have been like to be alive as such a beast. The voles they would have caught, the golden collars they would have worn. The real cat mummies are filled with bones and a heart. The nothing mummies are filled with prayers written on slips of papyrus, organs of faith. If scientists came and cut them open, the nothing mummies wonder, would the little piece of hieroglyphed papyrus rolling out be any less beautiful than the dried raisin of a heart? Aren't they not only the container, but the prayer itself? Enshrouded and encased, the animal mummies are trying to be patient. They did not expect the afterlife to be lit with flickering fluorescent bulbs. Darkened sarcophagi, woven boats rowed across the heavenly river, glimmering, gorgeous night. That was what they thought would be in store after they died, and priests washed them with palm wine and pulled white linen tight. Voles imagined their emergence into the next life, a place filled with nuts to pour, holes to hide in, secrets to keep. When the newly mummified eggs dreamed, they could almost feel something inside them begin to peck. But time has no ending, and forever meant forever. Someone's fingertips prepared these animals for the farthest of journeys. Their noses were stuffed with peppercorns, their bellies with lichen, and their eyes were replaced with onions. The cat mummies allow themselves one fantasy. If only there had been no such thing as an archaeologist. To think of the day they were dug up makes the cat mummies sick. Awake for the first time in thousands of years, they peered out, wanting to see, finally, the afterlife. Instead, the inside of a crate. The inside of a canvas tent, and then someone began, with fine-tipped tools, to dissect them. If only they had remained entombed in the cool earth with their kings. We were not afraid of eternity, or forever, they think. They would have made the journey to the other side, no matter how long it took, no matter how furiously, how magnificently long. The museum at night is tomb-like and comforting. Without the lights, without the visitors, without the plaque on the wall, the animal mummies can almost believe they are in their right place. A clay cave. The very center of a pyramid. Maybe, the voles hope, it is not the end. This could be only one of the worlds they must visit before they reach their true destination. Perhaps, the baboons pray, the animal mummies have much to look forward to. This place could be nothing more than a test of their faith. No matter how many disappointing days begin with the hesitant blinking of a fluorescent bulb, there is always another night on the way. The time to dream is plenty. What if, the eggs imagine, they have not yet left the shore? The tossing waves of the Nile are still ahead, and beyond them, the true afterlife. Kings and queens wait to receive rodents, baboons, and cats. Their royal arms open, welcoming home their great, delicate slaves.
Do not save the ferocious, save the tender. It was dark all the time. And so it was dark when the ship's captain crept into the corner where his young daughter was asleep. It was dark when he carried her out onto the deck and raised her up in the moonlight to better see his claim. The whole sky turned green with fire. The girl looked up at her father, at his matted beard. He said, "I loved you first." He thought of her 9 years, all of them under his care. "You loved me before you hated me? I loved you before anyone else did. I'll love you after whoever buys you stops." The captain lowered his head and kissed her on the mouth. She smelled like fish oil. She turned away. The sea churned below them, and the captain was no less lost. Through the girl's thick clothes, a little bit of human heat escaped. The girl was young enough to seem alive. He said, "We're lost. We've been lost for weeks. I'll take something good before I die." The captain kissed her again, mashed at her with his thick tongue. Yet more sea rolled under them, yet more water. The girl pulled her head back, looked up at him. From a leather belt, she drew a blade, which glinted. It might have been the only clean thing on board. The girl raised the knife, and she sliced her father's lips. By morning, the captain's face had begun to blister and rot. And at the very same time, the ship began to blister and rot, as if the man and the bilge were one body, as if he had hot-mouthed kissed a hole through the old lumber, straight to the glacial abyss. In a single day, the bottom softened, and the craft split open. Men and women and children and babies and chickens and goats and bricks of butter and yogurt and dried meat and murky vats of alcohol bobbed on the freezing surface for a few breaths before starting the slow, sinking journey to the bottom of the world where the muck-thick gods would welcome them. Two men, Asa and Per, were belly-flopped across what wood was left, praying to 1,000 different gods. The water was dark and clear and miles deep. There were pieces of ice, dirt gritty and luminous blue, floating. The heart tripped and panted with a desire to save. The body knew not to go in after the beloveds. The fearful skin pressed away onto the shingle, away from the blue. Asa, from the cage of his head, watched three ghostly women disappear below him, their leather coats opening and waving like the skirts of a jellyfish. Their legs, those unkicking tendrils white as pearls, were sinking treasure. Women's legs in those days were hidden beauty, cloth-covered and unmemorized. A shame, Asa's twirling mind said. A shame to have kept that flesh hidden, seeing how short its time turned out to be. It had been easy to think that arms were for hoisting and hauling. The only fire was a rope burn on the palm. Per watched everything go down. He craned over the edge of the raft, his right arm in the water, reaching. Per gathered a bowl, a man's undershirt, a comb carved from the antler of a reindeer. What an impossible creature that seemed then, land-sturdy and strong-footed on the big, traversable surface of ice and tundra. Per's arm turned stiff, but he did not remove it. When his wife sank below him like he knew she would, he reached for her, touched her ankle, but could not grab because his hand had frozen by then. Asa had seen Per and his wife together over the month at sea, and it had been unremarkable. She handed him one thing, he handed her another. She slept in the women's quarters, he in the men's. Now Asa saw that Per was a body severed from itself. It made no sense for one to exist without the other. There is no such thing as half a heart still beating. Asa's throat stinging with salt, he thought of the gods waiting to catch her. The giant man and his 1,000 daughters, their pots full of sweet liquor, gathering bodies to dance with in the everlasting celebration of death and cold and water and darkness. Per put his face in the water, but Asa pulled it out by the hair and made him drink the air. Where? 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 Asa sang, somewhere in the foggy forest of his mind. Drift, drift, drift. The captain, on another shingle, turned himself over and looked up instead of down. His ship, his crew, his daughter went deeper and deeper below him. He just lay there, flattened by the cloud-heavy sky. He could have rolled into the blue ice, been dead in seconds. He chose torture because his heart wanted it, because it was warm. Currents brought the captain close, and Asa reached for him and lashed the raft together with a strip of cloth torn from his shirt. "Captain," he said, "I am no longer." "You survived. We have to call you something." "Halvar," said the captain, "but I won't last." His split lips bled. Nothing propelled that small craft, not wind, not waves, not hope. The three men had no wishes for themselves. They lacked the strength to drown themselves and the strength to break off a loose slat and begin to paddle. They did not have enough blood in their hearts to be hungry or tired or sleepy or dead or alive. They were three thick trunks cut down. Asa had not reached into the frozen murk because he had no love to save. He would not have believed lonelier was possible. He rested his head on the wood and smelled its tree-bloody resin. Not dying was the surprise. Washed up on a beach white with crystallized salt, the three men continued to lie still, feeling waves below them that were not there. They half slept, half breathed, half lived. It was a hawk that woke Esa, the shrill call she made before diving, soaring back up with a gray rabbit, legs still running in the air. Esa found his feet, stood dizzy on the earth, trying not to throw up, trying not to fall down. No fires, no people, no dogs or horses. Granite mountains jagged behind them, and the shore was a white plain. Shrubs and trees scratched upward. The salt water melted a dark border of pebbled sand between what was frozen and what was liquid. Ice groaned beneath the weight of the sky. The three men were held there, between upper gods and lower. Halvar took Per's dead arm off with a sharp rock. Esa had a needle in the satchel that he wore, always around his body. It was an inelegant wound, bound with three of Asa's long hairs braided together. They expected the arm to infect and green, to kill the body to which it belonged, but each day it healed more. The scar hardened into a ropey tangle. They built a hut out of snow and carved benches on which to sit and sleep. It held the body heat, what body heat there was. In the spring, once the snow had melted, they planned to build a longhouse into a hillside using rocks and mud and logs. The sun would stop setting and any living thing would hurry to grow as much as it could before the light left. Even the roof of the longhouse would green over with unripe grass. Per discovered a whale carcass down the beach and set to work on it, building rib from rib with driftwood, turning the skeleton of the deep swimmer into the skeleton of a surface floater. He was not bothered by the slowness of his progress, his one arm sore and tired. He had time, all of time, and where he would sail, even he did not know. Back to the middle? Back to his sunken wife? Halvar's lips healed into an ugly scowl. He began to tunnel, to dig himself down into the ice and snow. He made a maze, as if no kind of lost was lost enough. And Asa? Asa needed no task to remind him that he would die alone. He sat at the top of the bluff, watching the horizon for anything at all. Survival of body was not the question for the three lost men, not yet anyway. There were fish in the sea, reindeer to be hunted, washed-up branches to be sharpened into spears. There was snow that could be melted and drunk. The three men ate their breakfast together around the fire pit in their world of lost ice. They took turns boiling the dried meat until it softened and they could chew it. It felt like nutrition, but not like food. They let the meat steam fog their faces like some warm, wet heaven. They thought of honey, finger-scooped and glistening. They remembered summer, bushes swollen with berries. They remembered the black-red rot on the ground, thick with flies. The men would have eaten that now. Greedily. Asa wanted to say good morning, but he didn't, because morning meant afternoon, and afternoon meant evening, and he could not think of another night. The other two stooped their shoulders over their bowls and drank the hot watery broth.